servants and masters. In Colossians chapter 3, we are going to read Colossians chapter 3 from verse 22. Colossians 3 from verse 22. Bond servants, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service as men pleasers, but in sincerity of heart, fearing God. And whatever you do, do it heartily, as to the Lord, and not to men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance, for you serve the Lord Messiah. But he who does wrong will be repaid for what he has done, and there is no partiality. This whole section that we are doing, from verse 17 right down to chapter 4, verse 1, is the practical section of human relationships, earthly relationships. And this one of the most important areas is workers, the workplace. Today, what characterizes the workplace is the adversarial approach. There's always an adversarial attitude. Not only that, but employers find that their employees are too often unreliable. They don't stay with it. They quit at a moment's notice. They get into a huff, they quit. Or if they are given a job to do, they do it only half as well as they should. Here's the opportunity for the child of God to pioneer what it means to be a faithful employee. And the supreme reason why we seek to serve our masters and to give them a full day's work for a full day's pay is because we serve another master that is higher than they. And that is what drives us. That is what motivates us. That's what keeps us going when we have bad bosses that are hard on us. In verse 22, he's talking particularly to bond servants. But today, of course, there isn't the same situation as faced the believers then. So the term would apply to employees or to all those that are under authority. What is the major area of weakness in employees? It's the area of obedience. And it's not by accident that we started with husbands and wives and children and fathers before we come to servants and masters, because it starts in the home. It starts when the child is small. This trend to disobey, this rebelliousness, it starts in the home. And if the parents aren't vigilant and seek to train the child and discipline the child and steer the child and curb its rebelliousness, that rebelliousness comes into adulthood, and as a result, adults behave just like children. Have you ever seen the United Nations? Don't you get a feeling sometimes they should all be thoroughly spanked and sent home? Well, that is how it happens. It happens when they're small. The parents do not correct them. And so they grow up, the petulant child becomes the petulant adult, and so on. So the major area of weakness is obedience. Obey in all things. This is contrary to ambitiousness. There is such a thing as good ambition, but obedience sometimes is sacrificed to ambition. The lack of obedience is really a form of theft. You're robbing your master or your employer of the loyalty and of the service that he expects and hopes for. We are to obey, here verse 22, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh. That means everything lawful and honest that is in line with the word of God. We are not talking here of anything but biblically correct behavior. In 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 1 and 2, there's a principle here that applies to those that have believing masters. 1 Timothy chapter 6 verse 1 and 2. Let as many bond servants as are under the yoke count their own masters worthy of all honor, so that the name of God and his doctrine may not be blasphemed. And those who have believing masters, let them not despise them because they are brethren, but rather serve them because those who are benefited are believers and beloved. Teach and exhort these things. There was a printer, a Christian printer, back in London, who confided in our pastor. He said, "The worst employees I have are Christians." He said, "The non-Christians are better employees than the Christians." So my pastor asked him, "In what way?" He says, "Well, when they take their lunch break, they often come back 5-10 minutes late. But brother, we were having a prayer meeting." Well, you're not paid to pray. You're paid to work. If you want to pray, do it in your break. Don't take time out from the master's hours of employment. Our pastor repeated that to us, and he said how important it is for us to be honest and not to take advantage of our good employers. Obey in all things your masters according to your flesh. That is, those that have authority over us. Reminding us also in saying so that they're only masters according to the flesh. They're physical masters. They're not spiritual. Where it comes to a conflict between Messiah as our master and these people as masters, first of all, we have to obey God. Remember how the apostles put it? We ought to obey God rather than men, when they were threatened and commanded not to speak in the name of the Lord Yeshua. In the first letter to the Corinthians, chapter 7, this principle is again underlined. And it's put like this. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 from verse 21 to 23. Were you called while a slave? Do not be concerned about it. But if you can be made free, rather use it. For he who is called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's freedman. Likewise, he who is called while free is Messiah's slave. You were bought at a price. Do not become slaves of men. There's the limitation, the biblical limitation. We are really serving our heavenly master, and our earthly master is the one through whom we serve our heavenly master. And then the Bible also says here in verse 22, not with eye service as men pleasers. That is to say, you do the job whether they're watching you or whether they're not. Because in another sense, you are doing it for eye service. But that eye service is the eye of your master on you, your heavenly master. Remember what Abraham's maid said? Thou, God, seest me. She understood that God was observing her. And that should be our motto as well, that all the time we are under the eye of our master, and therefore we do it as under his eye. But as far as earthly masters are concerned, not with eye service as men pleasers. We don't just do a job when they're around. We are true to them, whether they're watching us or whether they're not. This is the godly thing to do. Joseph was like that. He was so faithful, his master left everything in Joseph's hand. He didn't know what he ate. He didn't know what was in Joseph's hand except for the food that he ate. That's how faithful Joseph was. And when Joseph's master's wife sought to seduce him, he said, "How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" So he was under no illusion that God was watching him. To do eye service is to be men pleasers, but the believer, the child of God, is called to be a God pleaser first. And in that sense, he will seek to be an example. In Numbers chapter 11 and verse 4. Numbers 11, verse 4. Now the mixed multitude who were among them, that is, the mixed multitude that came out with the people of Israel from the land of Egypt, yielded to intense craving. So the children also wept again and said, "Who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we ate freely in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. But now our whole being is dried up. There's nothing at all except this manna before our eyes." How did their disobedience to God begin? Through the bad example of others. And therefore, as men pleasers, we do not follow the bad example of others who may be our fellow employees. This is a snare that many have fallen into. When one employee begins to grumble, it spreads like wildfire throughout the whole office or the factory, and soon everybody is grumbling. What's happening here? It's taking an evil example, following the bad example of others. And God says, this is not the way my people are to behave. In Exodus chapter 23, verse 2, God says, "You shall not follow a crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after many to pervert justice." You shall not follow a crowd to do evil. The herd instinct. The child of God knows better than to follow the herd. The child of God first thinks, what does God want me to do? How should I be carrying myself? So we avoid these evil motives. When Peter wrote in the first letter of Peter, chapter 4, verses 3 to 5, he also emphasized this. 1 Peter chapter 4, from verse 3 to 5. "For we have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles," and by that he meant the unbelievers, the heathen, "when we walked in lewdness, lusts, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. In regard to these, they think it strange that you do not run with them in the same flood of dissipation, speaking evil of you. They will give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead." Break out from the mold. Be independent. Cultivate a robust independence from the feeling, from the bad manners of unbelievers. Let's strike out a new path. Let us see if we can be an example. You'll find that when you do so, that you will arouse resentment. They think it's strange that you run not with them to the same excess of riot. They speak evil of you. No, we are to do it in singleness of heart, not to be show-offs, but because we fear God. And that's how this verse ends, verse 22. "But in sincerity of heart, fearing God. I do it because I am a child of God. I take my stand because I'm a child of God. I'm not going to be sanctimonious about it, but that's the fact. I'm under new management. That should be the motto of the child of God. Fearing the true God in sincerity of heart. When David was crowned king, finally, over all Israel, we read that there came representatives from the 12 tribes. And this is what was said in their commendation. They were not of a heart and a heart. They were not of a double heart. They were single-hearted. They had a single aim to honor David. And that is the picture that is applied to us as well. No man can serve two masters. We serve the Lord Yeshua, the one true master. Fearing God can be translated fearing the Lord. Nehemiah was a great governor over the people of Judah. In the fifth chapter of the book of Nehemiah, chapter 5, he mentions something where he broke the mold. Nehemiah chapter 5. He had been appointed by the emperor Artaxerxes to rule over the people of Judah and to supervise the rebuilding of the wall of Jerusalem. This is what he says about the way he carried himself. Verse 14, Nehemiah 5, verse 14. Moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year until the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the governor's provisions. But the former governors who were before me laid burdens on the people and took from them bread and wine besides 40 shekels of silver. Yes, even their servants bore rule over the people, but I did not do so because of the fear of God. He broke the mold. He said, my people are poor. They're struggling. I will not take advantage of them. It is my legitimate claim over them, but I will not exercise it. And Paul said the same thing. He wrote to the Corinthians and he said, I had a right to be supported of you, but for the sake of the gospel, I disclaimed that right. I waived it. I did not claim that right so that the truth of the gospel might continue with you. He had adversaries who were ready to pounce the moment he took support from them and to say, you see, he does it for money. We break the mold. That heavenly poet George Herbert wrote these lines. Teach me, my God and King, in all things thee to see, and what I do in anything, to do it as for thee. Not rudely as a beast to run into an action, but still to make thee prepossessed and give it his perfection. This is the famous stone that turneth all to gold, for that which God doth touch and own cannot for less be told. A housewife, homemaker, had a motto over her kitchen sink. Divine service held here 3 times daily. Do you know what she meant? I serve God when I cook. I serve God when I wash dishes as much as I serve God when I'm in his house and praying with his people. Divine service held here 3 times daily. She understood quite correctly that when we live our life for God, whether you're sweeping the floor, washing the dishes, cleaning the windows, or any other menial task, you are doing it for him, first of all, with an eye to please him in great and small things. She was a wise lady that said that, that put that motto on her kitchen window. And so we come to verse 23. And whatever you do, do it heartily, as to the Lord and not to men. With all your heart, do it. There is no distinction, really, between sacred and secular. We have been called to be priests to God, you and I, all fellow believers. Messiah has made us priests to God, and the priests always were aware of their calling to be priests. And whatever they did it as priests to God. And therefore, we have this clinching argument. And whatever you do, do it heartily, as to the Lord and not to men. It's a repeat of verse 17, isn't it? And whatever you do, in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Yeshua, giving thanks to God the Father through him. That would stop us, wouldn't it, from that hasty word, that unkind act. There was a time when the Ark of God was kept in the house of a man called Obed-Edom. You read about it in the second book of Samuel, chapter 6. Can you imagine Obed-Edom and his wife and the children having a squabble when the ark was in the house? There was the place where the ark was kept, and as they came into the house, they would remember, the ark is here. That is the symbol of the throne of God, and it is a token of the presence of God. How can we fight? How can we raise our voices? So the sense of the presence of God was a curb to their impatience. It was a guide to the way they spoke to one another. And in 3 months' time, we read, the fame of their blessing reached the ears of King David. In 3 months, the change was so noticeable, the blessing was so palpable, so evident, that people said to King David, the Lord has blessed Obed-Edom and all his family. This is what should guide us, the sense of the presence of God, that God is listening to our conversation. He is watching us. That pricks our consciences too, doesn't it? No, whatsoever you do, do it heartily, as to the Lord and not to men. Daniel was like that. Daniel the prophet. The king, Darius, had appointed him as one of three presidents, and Daniel was so faithful, he worked so heartily for God without a view to promotion, just in order to be faithful. The result was he was the king. King Darius thought to promote him over all the others. Do it heartily, work heartily, work from the soul. Ecclesiastes tells us this in chapter 9. Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 10. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going. Do it now. You may never get another opportunity. Work heartily, as to the Lord, that is, with our eye to him, towards him. We want to please him. We may not please our superior. He may be a very ungrateful boss. But still, we say, nevertheless, at thy word, I will do it. As Peter, when he was told by the Lord to let down his nets for a draught, he said, Master, we haven't succeeded, nevertheless, at your word, I will do what you say. The same attitude should be in us. Nevertheless, at your word, I will work hard at this, even though I am not acknowledged by my superior. That's the only thing that will help you to survive. Because sooner or later, we all have a work situation where we are not appreciated, where we are put down, where we are slapped down, and we are disheartened. What is going to carry us through? The answer is, I do not work for man primarily, God is my master, and it is to him that I must give account. That's what will carry you through. Not unto men. In the second book of Kings, chapter 10. Second book of Kings, chapter 10. We get the antithesis of this. We get the complete opposite. Second Kings 10, verse 15. We're reading about Jehu, the general that was appointed by God to destroy the family of Ahab. Verse 15. Now when he departed from there, that is, when Jehu departed from there, he met Jehonadab, the son of Rechab, coming to meet him. And he greeted him and said to him, "Is your heart right as my heart is toward your heart?" And Jehonadab answered, "It is." Jehu said, "If it is, give me your hand." So he gave him his hand, and he took him up to him into the chariot. Verse 16. Then he said, "Come with me and see my zeal for the Lord." So they had him ride in his chariot. Jehu made great profession of loyalty to God and of integrity of heart. But when we read on the story of Jehu, we find that he didn't care for God at all. He just served his own ambition. And once he got what he wanted, he abandoned God. He departed from God. We're not to do it as to men. The Pharisees, they fasted, they prayed, but they did all things for to be seen of men. And we have our modern Pharisees too. Not necessarily Jewish. Even in the church, we have Pharisees who love to be acknowledged, who love to be seen, who have to have their pictures placarded everywhere on their magazines. Pharisees. We're not to be like that. The Lord Yeshua, we read about him, he didn't even lift up his voice in the streets. He did not seek prominence. Well, let's continue. Now, verse 24, the reason why we do everything heartily as to the Lord and not to men is, here's the reason. Knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance, for you serve the Lord Messiah. You have to know that this is true. You have to believe it. It is true. The trouble is, we often have conflict of faith when things go hard with us. Messiah had the same conflict with discouragement. Isaiah chapter 49. In Isaiah 49, Messiah is being addressed, is addressing the nations of the world. This is the voice of Messiah through the prophet, Isaiah 49 verse 1. "Listen, O coastlands, to me, and take heed, you peoples from afar. The Lord has called me from the womb, from the matrix of my mother. He has made mention of my name. And he has made my mouth like a sharp sword. In the shadow of his hand he has hidden me and made me a polished shaft. In his quiver he has hidden me. And he said to me, 'You are my servant, O Israel, in whom I will be glorified.'" Here is the conflict, verse 4. "Then I said, 'I have labored in vain. I have spent my strength for nothing and in vain.'" There was the conflict. How did he face it? By facing the facts. "Yet surely my just reward is with the Lord, and my work with my God." What was it that carried Messiah through the conflict that he had? Because we are told to consider him that endured such great contradiction of sinners against himself. What was it? "My just reward is with the Lord, and my work with my God." And when at last accounts are squared, God will render to every man according as his work has been. Not for his work, but according to his work. "Knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance, for you serve the Lord Messiah, from the Lord, that is, Messiah is the true judge. He is depicted in the book of Daniel as receiving dominion and power and glory. Isaiah the prophet says, the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our king. He will save us. You shall receive. That means it is certain to happen. God does not lie. Every man shall receive in his according to the things that he has done in the body. And the book of Hebrews tells us, God is not unrighteous to forget your work and labor of love which you have showed to his name, in that you have ministered to the saints and do minister. And right at the end of the Bible, in Revelation chapter 22, once again Messiah underlines this. And don't let anybody trip you up by saying, oh, you're mercenary if you do it for reward. Even Messiah, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross. There is a reward for those that follow. And people like that, who talk like that, would scream if they didn't get their pay packet at the end of the week. They are thoroughly inconsistent. Revelation chapter 2, verse 12. And behold, I am coming quickly, and my reward is with me to give to everyone according to his work. Yes, you shall receive. It is certain to happen. What is this sure reward that is spoken of? It is heaven. It is eternal glory. The Bible tells us, eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor has it entered the hearts of men, the things which God has prepared for them that love him. We are going to get one great surprise when we get to heaven. We'll say, all this just for that puny little thing I did down there? It'll be out of all proportion to our step of obedience. This is the encouragement that is held forth before the child of God. The inheritance, because you serve Messiah. I heard of a young man whose pastor wanted to get him matched. And this young man always dodged the efforts of his pastor to match him up with someone. The pastor said, I would like you to meet so-and-so. She's a very nice young person. She's just suited to you. No, thank you, pastor. He kept running away for a whole year. This is true. It's happened here in BC. At the end of the year, his pastor was so importunate, he thought, well, just to lay this ghost down once for all, I'll meet this person that pastor's been talking about. When she walked in at the door, he stared and he said, I've been running away from this for a year? He realized the pastor was right. She was just the one. They got married. He realized that he'd been running away from something that was only for his highest happiness. So we see here that also from this, there is a reward of the inheritance, for you serve the Lord Messiah. He is our true, he is our only master. Master, says Peter, it is good for us to be here. It was on the Mount of Transfiguration. Let us make three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. Then the Shekhinah overshadowed them, a bright cloud, like that cloud that led the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt. And a voice came from the cloud saying, this is my beloved son. Hear him. He is our master. You serve the Lord Messiah. He is Messiah, our Lord. But there's also a warning. Verse 25. But he who does wrong will be repaid for what he has done. And there is no partiality. Either servant or master will be penalized. It doesn't only refer to the servant, it refers to the master as well. In the law, God said, if a master hits his slave and knocks his tooth out, for the tooth's sake, the master must give the slave his freedom. Or if he knocks his eye out, he's to let the slave go free because of the loss of the slave's eye. So the master lost his servant because of the wrong, the violence he had done. When Shaul wrote to his dear friend Philemon, he said to him, and it's interesting, Philemon lived in Colossae, the city to which this letter was directed. In Philemon, he says in verse 18, but if he, that is your runaway servant Onesimus, that if he has wronged you or owes anything, put that on my account. He recognized the right of the master to be compensated for the wrong that Onesimus had committed. And he didn't say, cancel the debt. He said, I will pay it. He also reminded Philemon that when a slave ran away from his master, he was not to be brought back into slavery again. And that's why he wrote this letter, receiving back, but not as a slave anymore, but as a beloved brother. But as for the wrong he has done, I will pay it. I will pay it for him. He cannot pay it. He that doeth wrong will be repaid for what he has done. Shaul recognized compensation had to be paid. Wrong. What kind of a wrong? Unfaithfulness or injustice? Unfaithfulness. The farmers in the valley here, in the Fraser Valley, some of them have given up in despair when it comes to getting pickers who will stay to the end of the season, or at least who will stay to the end of the day. And so their crops, their raspberries or strawberries or whatever, their crops, they can never depend on those people who come at the beginning of the day, that these people will stay to the end of the day. There are some people who do, but there are too many that walk out on their employer. That is unfaithfulness. That is unjust. Remember the servant Messiah spoke about that hid his talent in the earth? What was the sin of that servant? He didn't do anything with it. He didn't let it do anything that might have brought his master gain. He was living, maintained by his master, but he would not work for his master. And it was all based on his assessment of his master's character. Our assessment of our master's character has nothing to do with the principle of doing what we should as employees. How do we receive? The Bible says there is such a thing as retribution. God brings retribution. God says, then that honor me, I will honor, and they that despise me shall be lightly esteemed. From man, there's also retribution. A notorious example of that is found in the second book of Samuel, chapter 4. Unfaithful, unjust servants, and the record of what David did with them, or to them. 2 Samuel chapter 4. David was not yet crowned king over all Israel. The tribe of Judah had crowned him king over themselves. But the rest of the tribes of Israel were following the son of Saul called Ish-bosheth. Verse 5. 2 Samuel chapter 4 and verse 5. Then the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, Rechab and Baana, set out and came at about the heat of the day to the house of Ish-bosheth, who was lying on his bed at noon. And they came there all the way into the house, as though to get wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach. Then Rechab and Baana his brother escaped. For when they came into the house, he was lying on his bed in his bedroom, Then they struck him and killed him, beheaded him and took his head, and were all night escaping through the plain. And they brought the head of Ish-bosheth to David at Hebron. Was David pleased that his rival was dead? No. Verse 9. But David answered Rechab and Baanah, his brother, the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite, and said to them, "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all adversity, when someone told me, saying, 'Look, Saul is dead,' thinking to have brought me good news, I arrested him and had him executed in Ziklag. The one who thought I would give him a reward for his news, how much more when wicked men have killed a righteous person in his own house on his bed? Therefore, shall I not now require his blood at your hand and remove you from the earth?" He had those unfaithful, murderous servants executed. And having executed them, he cut off their hands and their feet, which had been accessories to their murder. And he hanged them up, because whatever was hung was symbolized a cursed thing. But they took the head of Ish-bosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner in Hebron. He that does wrong will be repaid for what he has done, and there's no partiality. Wrongdoers are impartially masked. God said, "You shall not have respect of persons in judgment." There is the word for employees, for servants. But now we come to masters. Chapter 4 and verse 1. "Masters, give your bondservants what is just and fair, knowing that you also have a master in heaven." This would conclude this practical section on what it means to be holy in everyday life. Are you an employer? Do you have someone under you? May I include in this the customer in the department store? The department stores generally have this motto, "The customer is always right." Now, the customer may be wrong, but that very attitude in the store makes the customer behave in a very imperious way at times against the employee. But that person who's serving you is a human being. He or she is your fellow human. You're not to look down on them or speak to them and flout the authority that the department store has given to the customer. See what I mean? We have to be very careful that we maintain and preserve a respect for our fellow human beings, whatever their costume might be. If they are dressed in the costume of the store, still their dignity has to be preserved. So masters involves even customers in department stores or situations like that. What are the masters to do, the employers? They're to provide for their servants or their employees. They're to give them a fair wage for a fair day's work. And they're to give what is just and fair, or the right kind of recompense, knowing that you also have a master in heaven. There is the principle. The servant serves, I serve my Lord. He is my master. The boss also serves. He says, the Lord is my master too. Job exemplified this. He said, when one of my slaves had an argument or had a reason for remonstrating with me, I did not despise their cause. I let them speak to me. That was unusual in those days for the slaves to dare to open their mouth to their master. But Job said, I let them reason with me, contend with me. When they felt that I was being unjust or unfair, I listened to them, because he says, God made him as well as God made me. God made me as well as him. And we are both obliged, we're both answerable to the same Lord. Masters, give your bond servants what is just and fair, knowing that you also have a master in heaven. In other words, the believing master is God's servant. Messiah himself said, I am among you as one that serves. And I've left you an example that you should serve one another. We are fellow humans. We share a common redemption. When the people of Israel were told to bring money for their redemption, as a token of their redemption, the poor were not to give more, the poor were not to give less, the rich were not to give more than half a shekel of silver. It was a standard price to teach our people that redemption for rich and for poor is exactly the same. Bad masters threaten. They cheat their employees. They are overbearing. They make unlawful demands. They abuse their authority. Saul told his servants, rise up and slay the priests of the Lord because they helped David. The servants of Saul didn't draw their swords. They refused to obey such an unlawful demand. Unwise pampering on the other side. The book of Proverbs says that he who brings up his servant delicately will eventually have him to be like his son and heir. Pampering is just bad as well. But on the positive side, a good master will allow his employee to achieve his or her full potential, even if it means that eventually that servant may be better at the job than the boss. That's a good master. Letting them develop their full potential, giving rewards for faithful service, the demands faithful, giving them a chance to rest, not drive them too hard. Adequate provision for them. Abraham was like that. He looked after his servants. He taught them the ways of God. The centurion had a slave, and that slave was very dear to him, like his own son. He was a good master, and the blessing comes on the master, as we read in Ephesians 6 and verse 8. Knowing that whatever good anyone does, he will receive the same from the Lord, whether he is a slave or free. Well, time's gone. We've covered servants and masters this morning. And God willing, next time we will come back to the concluding exhortations in Colossians chapter 4. For now, we just close with a word of prayer, and then please feel free if you have questions or comments.